What I have learned. The first talk at Gutenberg College's 2014 Summer Institute and 20th Anniversary Celebration was presented by David Crabtree on July 31, 2014. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Thank you all for coming. This is going to be a lot of fun. I've been thinking about what I would say in this talk ever since we came up with the topic. It is more difficult than I thought. One reason for this difficulty is that most of what I've learned is inarticulable. It is unfortunate. It's hard to draft a talk about the inarticulable things that I have learned. I firmly believe that the most valuable things we learn are inarticulable, and this is what makes it so difficult to pass wisdom on from one generation to the next. The other problem is that I have difficulty separating out that which I learned in the past 20 years from that which I learned earlier. My mind contains my model of reality, my worldview. As I learn things, that worldview is amended in conformity with what I just learned. So it's frequently updated, but I do not keep track of when new conclusions get incorporated in and why. This would be good information to retain, but my brain does not do that well. Given that lack of chronological awareness, it seems to me that what I believe now is what I have always believed, making it hard to list the things that I have learned over the last 20 years. In fact, it seems to me that everything I know and believe has all been voiced by me many, many times in the last 20 years. I've been teaching for over 30 years now. There are many hours of my teaching that were recorded and are now preserved on our website. It stands as a witness to what I have said over the years. Much of it I don't even remember saying, but the bits and pieces I have listened to sound much like something I would say today. So I feel like I don't have anything new to say. This sense was recently reinforced by an incident involving one of my children. A few months back, my daughter came to me and asked for advice in response to a difficult situation that she was facing. As I offered my advice, she began to grin. When I was finished saying what I had to say, she said, "I can remember you saying the exact same thing when I was 8. She's 31. It occurred to me later that she could have been smiling out of incredulity that my thinking has not developed over so long a period. But that is not how I took it. I just assumed that she was marveling at my amazing consistency. So as I relate my thoughts, as you hear the things that you have heard me say many times before, I hope you will choose to marvel at my amazing consistency. The first and most obvious thing I have learned is how heavy is the weight of responsibility that comes with being the president. I wrestle with a wide range of problems, many of which I never imagined having to deal with when Gutenberg was being born. You would think that such a small college would not generate so great a set of responsibilities. But even though Gutenberg is tiny, the decisions that are made by its administration affect a relatively large number of people. For every decision that is made, I must take into account the board, the tutors, the staff, the students, the parents of students, the supporters, past students, future students, and the broader Gutenberg community. My sense of responsibility is greater with respect to some of those groups than for others, but I feel some responsibility with respect to all of these groups. I recently heard a radio interview with a comedian from Iceland. As a comedian, he frequently used local politics as material for his comedy shows. At one point, he joked that he would be a better mayor of his city, which was Reykjavik, than the one in office. In consequence of his joke, He received write-in votes from so many citizens that he was elected mayor. The interview that I heard was at the end of his term as mayor. The interviewer asked him what was his biggest surprise as mayor. He said that it was how different issues appear when one is actually responsible for the decisions that are made. As a result, he made many decisions as mayor that he would have been critical of as a comedian. My sense of responsibility is heightened by my conviction that little decisions are oftentimes as important as big decisions in shaping what kind of place Gutenberg is. How tutors respond to questions in class, the wording of memos about parking problems, tidiness in the classroom, these kinds of things are all important. How we deal with relatively trivial things like these communicates volumes to students about what we value and what we are really about. But this recognition creates a situation that is overwhelming. It places huge importance on the trivial day to day. This is overwhelming for two reasons. First, because there are so many of them. And second, because it is so difficult to determine what the impact of those decisions will be. It would be possible to be paralyzed by all those decisions, and sometimes they are paralyzing. I have sometimes simply not known what action to take at certain junctures. When such decisions could be postponed, I have done so in hopes that the best course of action would become more clear in the interim. In other instances, I have just picked one option, not really knowing what would be the best. Recognizing the importance of the trivial tends to push me toward another potential vice. If the trivial is important in shaping the institution, and if I am responsible for the institution, I need to be involved in all the trivial decisions of the college. This logic would lead me to be looking over the shoulder of every employee and volunteer all the time. This is obviously ridiculous. First of all, I don't have the time nor the knowledge and skill to critique the work of everyone else. And furthermore, it would be terribly demoralizing for me to be so meddlesome and distrusting of those working under me. This kind of micromanagement would destroy the college. This is the cause of the most difficult kind of question I have to deal with as president. When has an employee done something that warrants my corrective action? This is difficult for two reasons. First, do I really know better than the employee? The employee has obviously thought about what he's doing. He has reasons for his choice. Why do I think I know better? I could be wrong. The second problem is this. Will I do greater damage by interfering than would be done by allowing things to just proceed? These two considerations combine to make these kinds of decisions agonizingly difficult. So although my values and my understanding of how things work could lead me to be a micromanager, my style as president has, on the whole, been very laissez-faire. I tend to be slow to take action. My reluctance to take action is the product of both my personality and conviction. But my laissez-faire tendencies have become more entrenched over the past 20 years rather than shaken. It has become abundantly clear to me that taking action is not always beneficial. Whenever there is a problem, it causes pain. Wherever there is pain, people want relief from that pain. To fail to take action to address suffering is understood to be a failure to take suffering seriously. But I am not attracted to taking action just for the sake of taking action. I recognize there is a place for this kind of response. It is like a placebo. And the placebo effect is a real phenomenon. But placebos can be overused. If a placebo is prescribed every time there is a twinge of pain, it reinforces the idea that all pain should be addressed with a pill. I am convinced that there are times when pain simply needs to be endured and dealt with internally. Consequently, I do not take action unless I have some confidence that the action taken will actually improve matters. I could go on talking about the strange way I look at being the leader of this institution. As a result of my quirks and personality and conviction, I make a strange leader. I don't think that I could be the president of any other college. It is a tribute to the people on the board, the faculty, and the staff that we have been able to make things work at all. That Gutenberg College has survived for 20 years is truly a miracle. For the rest of my talk, I would like to turn my attention to a question that has been raised in the past year. Has Gutenberg changed? There is some background to the comments that follow that I want everyone here to be aware of. A few months ago, Jack offered a 6-week class to the public on the biblical view of sexuality. In his presentation, he took the position that to act on homosexual desires is wrong. It is a sin in the eyes of God. A few of our alumni were outraged and started up a conversation on the internet that eventually involved many of our alumni as to whether such views should be allowed to be voiced at Gutenberg. Much of that conversation was confined to a closed email exchange between several dozen of our alumni. I have not read that exchange and will not respond to any of the details. But one question that surfaced even before this exchange, and which was behind many of the comments, was whether Gutenberg has changed in the past few years. We know from surveys and things alumni have told us that many of our graduates look back at their educational experience at Gutenberg with great fondness, and I am glad that that is the case. I am convinced, based on my conversations with alumni, that this fondness is based on a wide variety of things. In some cases, this fondness is based on their educational experience. Sometimes it is based on the friendships they developed here. Sometimes based on a romanticized memories of Gutenberg. Oftentimes it is based on a combination of all of these. I am frankly surprised that there are such different characterizations of Gutenberg from people who studied here. I fear that it would be difficult to agree upon what Gutenberg used to be. This, of course, complicates the issue of whether or not Gutenberg has changed. But to a certain extent, the question as to what Gutenberg was need not be completely resolved to answer the question. The heart of the concern seems to be that Gutenberg used to be apolitical and has now become a part of the religious right. So with this in mind, I think I can address the question as to whether Gutenberg has changed without establishing precisely what it was. Concerns about Gutenberg changing go way back. I remember several years back, students coming to me and expressing their fears that we were bringing in such a large class of freshmen that it would completely change the college. If I remember correctly, we were anticipating a student body increase of 12 students that year. But I understand and share the concerns about Gutenberg changing. I have never wanted it to change. It has always had a special quality, and I don't want to lose that. I am sure that you are all aware of colleges that were founded for a certain purpose, and various measures, sometimes quite extensive measures, were taken to assure that the college never departed from that purpose. But over the years, the college evolved into something very different from what it was originally. I am convinced that there is nothing that can be done to make sure that a college will never depart from its original mission. But can anything be done to retard that departure? I have thought about this a lot. From the beginning of Gutenberg, I thought about what could be done to be sure that Gutenberg didn't stray from the goals and values on which it was founded. This is not an easy thing to do under any circumstances. The first thing that needs to be recognized is that Gutenberg has to change. To show that this is true, let's do a little mind experiment. We live in a world of flux. Everything is ever-changing. Wood rots, metal rusts, money inflates, software needs updates, people age. Let us pretend you could freeze Gutenberg just the way it is, every aspect of it. Even in this state, Gutenberg would change, because part of Gutenberg is its relationship to the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is constantly changing. So even if Gutenberg could be frozen still, as everything around it changes, it would be differently related to everything around it. The Amish did not used to be a tourist attraction. So changelessness is not an option. In a world of change, the best that can be done is to manage the change. Make those changes that enable the institution to maintain its original purpose in the midst of a changing world. This requires that the institution identify its non-negotiable essence in order to make sure that all changes be made with an eye to preserving that which is most important to maintain. So what is the core essence of Gutenberg College? It is not an easy matter to determine the essence of an organization. Every organization has multiple purposes. Let's take a soccer team as a simple example. A soccer team wants to win its games. It also wants to win the league championship. But it has other goals as well. It wants its players to improve. It wants the team to be able to have a continued existence. It wants the league to have a continued existence. It wants the fans to enjoy watching the games. It wants the fields where it plays its games to be in good shape. If it is a professional soccer team, then it wants to be profitable, etc. We could come up with a very long list of things that the team views as good things that it would like to achieve. Since an organization has many different values, it is easy to imagine that those values would constantly come into conflict one with the other. So those values have to be arranged hierarchically. Whenever there is a conflict between different values, the value which is held most highly needs to take precedence. Establishing that hierarchy is not an easy matter. If you are the owner of a soccer team, would you value more the profits generated by the team or a league championship? The answer to this would differ from one owner to the next. Different people in the organization would also answer this question differently. A player may not care about the profitability of the team, but may value the development of his playing skills more highly than anything else. Fans may not care about profitability, they just want a championship. In order for an organization to do well, there must be significant agreement with respect to this hierarchy of values. This is difficult to do in a small organization. Those difficulties are multiplied when the organization is larger. Biblical faith creates one more layer of complexity in this picture. The coach of a soccer team has another value in addition to the others. He has an obligation to conduct himself in a way that encourages all those around him to grow in maturity and in faith. So as he coaches his players and fosters better soccer skills, he must also keep in mind another value, a higher value, to foster maturity, wisdom, and faith. Notice that I said this is a higher value. In fact, this value takes precedence over all other values of the organization. The coach has this God-given responsibility with respect to his players. He has this responsibility with respect to the owner, the fans, etc. In fact, every human being has the responsibility to be a constructive influence in the lives of everyone he has dealings with. A good organization will recognize this transcendent value and make room for everyone in the organization to act accordingly. Gutenberg is an educational institution where the discussion of questions related to what it means to be a human being are standard fare. But it would not have to be so. As I have said to several of you over the years, we could be building boats together and do much the same thing. That is, we could be encouraging one another to be better human beings while working together building boats. The critical ingredient is a shared project that brings us together and creates the forum for us to interact one with the other. Having said that, the forum of a liberal arts curriculum has some advantages over boat building, with respect to this goal. It not only provides a forum in which we can interact, it is focused on the issue of what it means to be a human being. The curriculum is designed to explore explicitly the nature of wisdom. In this sense, Gutenberg is different from the hypothetical soccer team I was talking about earlier. For the soccer team, the development of wisdom and maturity was not an organizational goal. That was the individual goal of those involved, but not a goal of the organization. It is the organization's duty to stay out of the way of people pursuing their individual responsibility to foster wisdom in others, but it is not really an organizational goal. For Gutenberg, this is an organizational goal. So at Gutenberg, our individual goal coincides with the organizational goal in this respect. From my perspective, our efforts towards this end have not diminished. We have continued to seek to help every one of our students to grow in wisdom and maturity. Some students are more ready for help, for this help, others less ready. With some students, there are more opportunities to help, with others less. For some students, the relationship with tutors is more conducive to this than with others. In dealing with some students as tutors, we are equipped with the wisdom to be helpful. In other cases, our wisdom falls short. But we have always tried to do whatever we could to prepare each and every student to live wisely before God. From my perspective, this is the essence of Gutenberg College, and we have not compromised this. And from my perspective, that is the non-negotiable core of Gutenberg that should never change. So has Gutenberg changed? Is it fundamentally different than it was 6 to 10 years ago? I am quite confident that it is not. But as I mentioned earlier, the kind of change that students seem to be most concerned about is a drift towards political conservatism, and most disconcertingly, taking provocative and controversial positions. With respect to this, I would say that we have and have not changed. So this will require some explanation. There is not, and never has been, unanimity among our faculty with respect to politics. But I think it would be fair to say that the Gutenberg faculty has a decidedly conservative tilt on most issues. So that is not a change. It is also the case that Gutenberg has always been provocative and controversial. In fact, Gutenberg was provocative before it was Gutenberg. It might be helpful to review some history. When this organization was McKinsey Study Center, our teachings generated widespread concern in the church community in Eugene, Springfield, and beyond. And to a certain extent, that concern was very understandable. Having come out of conservative Christian culture, we were all very aware of the impact of that culture on the thinking of Christians who are immersed in it. That culture has some pernicious elements that get superimposed on the gospel message and obscure or even negate it. Our desire was to strip the cultural accretions away from the gospel itself, and this is an essential thing to do. Culture always presents a very difficult challenge to us as human beings. We are all born and raised in some kind of culture. That culture provides us with tools to make sense of all the information that comes our way. It includes assumptions about reality, ways of analyzing issues, ways of organizing information, etc. It is kind of like the operating system for a computer. It is the means by which we know what to do with the data input from our experience. Just as some operating systems are better than others, some cultures are better than others at providing us with the tools to understand our experience. But good or bad, the culture in which we are born provides us with the apparatus that we use to make sense of the world. Much of what we believe to be true is uncritically absorbed by us from our culture. Everyone in a given culture accepts a certain set of assumptions about the world. Those assumptions are the foundation for all of the activities of that culture and are interwoven into the fabric of everyday life. As a result, those assumptions are so widely and completely accepted by everyone around us that their quality as assumptions is completely hidden. They take on the status of self-evident truths that need no defense. These cultural taken-for-granteds don't seem to need any justification, and they are not something of which the people in that culture are concerned. They fly under the radar and are absorbed without notice. This is what makes them so dangerous. We are completely oblivious to them. Those assumptions seem to be simply descriptions of reality. Taken-for-granteds are seen as just the way it is. Some of those assumptions will stand up to close rational scrutiny. They do describe the way it is. Others, however, will not stand up to careful scrutiny. And in order to understand what is indeed true, we must become aware of those false assumptions that we have adopted from our culture. To have one's cultural assumptions challenged is not a trivial thing. Much of our identity is tied up with the culture that we identify with. So to challenge someone's cultural assumptions is most frequently taken to be a personal attack. It is a troubling experience. So it is not really surprising that when we challenged the cultural assumptions of the Christian community, this was greeted with some kind of mixture of fear and hatred. I would not argue that we did everything well. Some of the animosity that we aroused was undoubtedly due to our own foolishness. But some of it, I am convinced, was due to the sense that some of the issues we were raising had the potential of being life-changing, and that was a fearful prospect. A similar phenomenon has been experienced by those students who came to Gutenberg identifying strongly with Christian culture. We have raised many troubling issues and challenged fundamental assumptions about the world, and that has been a disturbing experience. Those of you who came to Gutenberg as conservative Christians felt the turmoil that this caused. I know that that was not fun for many of you, but I hope and pray that time will show that that was a constructive process. Jack is, without question, the most provocative among us. Jack speaks in very stark terms. He is also given to making provocative turns of phrase. Jack recently gave a series of talks entitled, "Why Jesus Would Not Have Been a Christian." You can hardly get more provocative. But from my perspective, there is something very valuable about the way Jack presents things. He forces people to make a choice, and we live in an age when the fence is crowded with perchers. So many of you are very well aware that we as tutors have taken this stance vis-a-vis Christian culture for many years. But things have changed. Whereas a few years ago we perceived the greatest threat to biblical faith was coming from the Christian subculture itself, that is to say that teachings and beliefs common in the Christian subculture were threatening to undermine and pervert the true teachings of the gospel. That is why we spoke out against the dangers of the Christian taken for granteds. But the Christian subculture has been so compromised by the dominant secular culture of America that it is no longer the greatest threat to true Christianity. The greatest threat is that dominant secular culture. The dominant secular culture has had an impact on all of us, and that impact is huge. Whether we recognize it or not, there is great pressure on all of us to adopt its values and assumptions. It is a constant battle to keep ourselves from capitulating to the culture. As an illustration of this, I will lay out for you one of my greatest struggles in this regard. As president of Gutenberg College, I am the one who is ultimately responsible for fundraising. I have never claimed that I am good at it, and I have a 20-year track record that justifies me not making that claim. There are three principles that inform all my decisions with respect to fundraising. First, it is good and proper that we inform people about who we are, what we are doing, and our financial needs. Two, there is nothing inappropriate about asking for money. Three, it is inappropriate to manipulate or coerce people to give. These are principles that I have been and continue to be committed to. So the principles are clear. But how those principles should be implemented is extremely difficult. For example, Where do you draw the line between informing and manipulating? If you receive an email informing you that Gutenberg College needs $10,000, I consider that information. What if you receive 2 emails to that effect? Is that still informing? What if you receive daily emails to that effect? At some point, those emails cease to be information emails and become harassment. But where do you draw the line? This question is compounded by the fact that different people have different sensibilities with respect to this issue. Some people are very sensitive to coercion, others not so much. So by what standard do you make this determination? How do you know where to draw the line? I have been astounded at how many times I have had to try to find this line. This issue comes up all the time, and every situation is slightly different. It is the same question posed in an infinite number of ways. In recent years, this has been particularly difficult. Our financial situation has been particularly acute. We have had to come up with significant sums of money by certain deadlines in order to continue the college, so a lot has been at stake. Failure to meet those deadlines would negatively affect a lot of people. In order to help us with fundraising, we have, over the past 4 years or so, talked with a half dozen people who specialize in that skill. For the most part, they all said much the same thing. The part I had the most difficult time accepting was the fact that their practices were so focused on maximizing dollars. For instance, they will say, if you do X, your contributions will go up 10%, according to the research. If you say Y, 15% more people will give donations. All of these kinds of observations can be interesting, but maximizing dollars is not the highest goal. And I found any advice that seemed to assume this to be the case very troubling. But in fairness, most of these consultants would not have said that it is. Nevertheless, I was frequently unnerved by the sense that when it came right down to it, the practices they were advocating were encouraging me to see people as donors rather than people. The practices they were advocating were not outrageous. They were mild compared to the kinds of fundraising practices with which we are bombarded all the time. They were, relatively speaking, non-manipulative and non-coercive. But we live in a culture that is accustomed to the bottom line, to money being the measure of all things. We live in a time when marketing is the most important skill there is. There are a whole passel of taken-for-granteds associated with marketing that are embedded in fundraising advice. So I found myself caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, we needed money. On the other hand, I did not want to engage in practices that are coercive or manipulative. A number of people were telling me in one way or another that our lack of money was because I am so Puritan with respect to fundraising. In fact, one foundation turned down a grant proposal that we submitted because they said our fundraising philosophy is underdeveloped. I am not interested in debating the soundness of the perspectives of the fundraising consultants or the foundation. They could all very well be right and I be wrong. My only point is this. The impact that our culture has on us is huge and largely imperceptible. It is vital that we be introspective and self-critical and identify those instances when we are being propelled by unexamined cultural assumptions in directions that, were we to stop and examine carefully, we would not opt to go because to do so would be unwise. It is a fight to keep ourselves aware of all the cultural and personal influences that are coming into play in the decisions we make, to be oblivious to those forces. If we seek to live godly lives, is disastrous. One thing we have sought to do at Gutenberg is to help you as students to understand the impact of culture on our lives, to help you to assess the various ways that it is influencing you. If we have done nothing more than to wrest you from the taken-for-granteds of the Christian subculture, only to turn you over to the taken-for-granteds of the secular culture, we have done you no service. So has Gutenberg changed? To the extent that there has been a change in Gutenberg, from my perspective, I would say that it lies in this. We have slowly come to recognize that for most of our students, the influence of secular culture is far greater than that of the Christian subculture. But you will ultimately have to judge for yourselves whether Gutenberg has changed. There is a lot at stake. Over the past 20 years, there have been a lot of difficulties. But all in all, it has been a very rewarding experience. There is something almost magical about the whole Gutenberg experience. Students come to Gutenberg still wet behind the ears. Their immaturity expresses itself in a wide variety of ways. Some are insecure and withdrawn, others are overconfident and boisterous. But over the course of their 4 years, a lot changes. Students learn a lot. They gain confidence, they gain humility, they learn to relate to one another with more respect, they learn to value other people. In short, they grow up. I am well aware that this is not absolutely unique to Gutenberg. To a certain extent, this would happen anywhere. Over a 4-year period, young people do grow up. But it does seem to me that something special happens at Gutenberg. There is a beauty of soul that is produced in students. It is hard to define and hard to characterize, but it is visible. I have seen it, other faculty have seen it, the people in the broader community have seen it. I can't lay out for you the exact confluence of factors that produce this result. I don't even know to what degree Gutenberg can take credit for it. But when something good is happening, and you don't know exactly what is causing it, it is hard to know how to make sure it continues. This is the kind of thing that makes baseball players superstitious. If a batter is hitting well, he does not want to change a thing so that the streak will continue. So players keep wearing the same socks, not wanting to jinx their luck. Similarly, it is tempting to want to freeze Gutenberg just the way it has been so that we can continue to facilitate our students' growth. No one would like to see Gutenberg continue to produce that beauty in students more than I would. I can't tell you how motivating that is. Money is needed to keep Gutenberg going, but the real fuel that keeps Gutenberg going is glimpses of that beauty of soul, whether it be in current students or past students. That has been the most gratifying part of the Gutenberg project. So in closing, I urge you to attend to your soul. As I age, it becomes increasingly apparent to me that life is short. The last 20 years have gone amazingly quickly. So keep up the fight. The struggle won't last much longer. And one day soon, you will stand alone and naked before your Creator and give an account for your life. And from my perspective, that will be the ultimate test of Gutenberg's worth. Did we do everything we could to prepare you for that day? I sincerely hope and fervently pray that the answer is yes.